With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. The latest information and analysis of major events from around the world. You're listening to Compass with Jason Olbourne on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, and thanks for joining me today for an important edition of Compass. Every edition, of course, is going to be extremely interesting and important, of course, with all the news that is coming around the world. But we've got a couple of issues here in Australia that are certainly worth their place on the world stage. One of them is the PricewaterhouseCoopers scandal that has broken out. And I just want to put a perspective on it today and give you a little bit more detail on that story. And of course, I want to deal with the Ben Roberts-Smith situation with the defamation case going against him yesterday. And I think it's very important that we understand the difficulties that go on with all of our military and understand that it is not as simple as just black and white from the perspective that maybe one soldier, as Nick McKenzie has explained, was the Lance Armstrong of the military. There is a lot more detail in all of this, and the fog of war, despite being dismissed by McKenzie in his story, is worthy of detail and perspective, and we'll cover that story a bit later on in the show. Have a little bit of fun with a couple of interesting developments that have also popped up during the week. One of them, a study about the origins of humans, and of course, I want to talk about China, but in this case, I'm going to talk about some of these new ideas and ingenuity that they're coming up with over there in China, extraordinary details. But the PwC scandal has all the hallmarks of a major scandal. The Tax Practitioners Board is considering expanding its probe into the leaking of confidential tax briefings by PwC, revealing it was reviewing an internal list of names after already banning one partner. As Terry McCran wrote in The Australian, this needs to focus not just on the specific murky issue. Yes, it might not be good, but even avoidable idea to get the top tax advisors to advise on complex tax legislation. But please, he says, are these tax practitioners really supposed to do their damnedest to utterly and permanently destroy their own businesses and incomes? Meanwhile, RBA Governor Philip Lowe, whose own job is under immense scrutiny, has supported consequences for PwC's breach of confidentiality, noting the firm's behaviour was unacceptable. The use of private information for this sort of commercial gain is wrong. It destroys trust. It's unacceptable, said Lowe. However, he confirmed the RBA did hold an ongoing consulting agreement with PwC that was entered into last year. They have the skills to help the ATO and the underlying tax legislation and rules get things right. That means legislation and tax practice that works to do what it's supposed to do, but it's also to do it efficiently, argues McCran. So on the one hand, we have top people from the accounting firms advising the tax office and the government on how to frame the legislation and tax rules so that they work. And then at the same time, advising their clients how to bluntly get around them. It's possible to envisage a reality where both can be done both effectively and ethically if you assume that greed is not a significant motivator, whereas greed, as McCran confirms, is actually the defining driver across the 21st century business sector.
The Pricewaterhouse scandal continues, and I've asked Jeff Shaw for his comment. Jeff is a former Victorian state MP and also a CPA, and I thought who better to get a perspective from both sides of this particular story here with PricewaterhouseCoopers partner Peter Collins being stood down and many others. And we're reading a bunch of different articles coming out in The Australian, Jeff, but one of the ones that I found very interesting is it seems that acting CEO Kristen Stubbins has thrown Collins under the bus, saying that he breached confidentiality, and it's becoming quite a complicated story. But as Terry McCran says, what's it really all about? If no confidential information was used to cut client tax bills, where exactly was this breach of confidence? And sort of saying it's a storm in a teacup. Jeff, as a both a CPA and a former MP. What's your perspective so far on this emerging story?
Well, I can see both points there. I can see Terry McCrann saying this is a storm, a teacup, and I believe it is. But I can also see the new PricewaterhouseCoopers person in charge who's defending her firm because they have a reputation that they want to keep, and certainly throwing him in the bus. You know, there's a scapegoat in every scandal, if you like. And don't you love how people build up to be a scandal? I think the biggest scandal here is the public service. The bloated, fat public service has all this money coming to it, has all the government powers that it requires pretty much, and the ATO themselves don't have the brain bank to work out legislation, anti-avoidance legislation, for large multinationals that they have to get a private group, Peter Collins and PwC, in to advise them on it. Haven't they got the brain bank there already? I mean, what are the ATO paid for if not to be able to draft legislation and bills that allow the capture of that revenue, if that's so the government so desires? So my thinking is storm in a teacup, certainly. And there's a couple of things that I found disturbing in the reporting, I guess, and people need to go a little bit maybe deeper, is that this guy was under contract, apparently. So he signed, non-competitive or non-disclosure, client confidentiality agreements. Now, if this Peter Collins opened his mouth to other people whilst on confidentiality, I would say he's broken something there. And I would say that, therefore, he may have to be looked at by the taxation practitioner board, which he was, and suspended for 2 years. But what was the reason for it? Did he break confidentiality like his the new boss of PwC said? It hasn't come out necessarily that that is the case. I think she might be preempting that. So my thinking is, if he broke confidentiality, yep, there's got to be there's some sort of commercial punishment for that, or suspension of license or whatever. But if he then after the budget was released and it was open to the public and all accountants, it's his obligation to let his clients know that these are the budget changes. Come in, this we need to discuss what we can do to better your position. That's what all accountants do. When a budget comes out and will affect your people that you know, you get them in, you're on the phone. Like I would be wanting to get people on the phone now with the Victorian state budget, talking to rental property owners about the new land tax that's coming up. That's just your responsibility as a proactive tax practitioner. Well, it's not really your responsibility, but if you want to be proactive with your client base, giving tax plan advice, you should be doing that sort of stuff. And PwC have exactly done that.
So this is where it becomes interesting, doesn't it? Because if Collins and others at PwC have gone forward to the tax office and not played their best game, in other words, they've held something back so that they could then feed that to the clients, then you've got a real problem, because you're kind of like an agent for two parties here. But this is not what's being alleged in all of this. This is kind of just that they've given the jump on their best work. So it becomes quite murky, but we can understand why it becomes something that people no longer trust either PwC and or the government. But you've highlighted something very important here, and that is how government and the public service are able to always seem to just be a step ahead of the scandal or the jump here. And I think the quote that that we talked about earlier is, no one gets sacked for hiring a big corporate. That's the idea in all of this, that it's always a way to palm that off. And here it is, a perfect example that the ATO has been found wanting. They don't have the brain power to do their own work. They hire in a private organisation, PwC, huge accounting firm, and then when they get caught out in all of this, it's kind of like, well, let's throw the entire company under the bus. And so you have a situation, I guess, in many ways, if we go back in history, Arthur Anderson and Enron was probably the biggest scandal of them all, but this is nothing like that in terms of it. It just seems like government attacking a big corporate for the sake of covering or protecting their own reputation. Is that a kind of a summary as how you've felt that this has sort of evolved at the moment?
Look, I think so. I think it's a story that some people wanted to write. They love using, if you can get a headline with scandal in it, it gets people excited, fearful, and pointing the finger. But the real finger is pointed at here, I think, at the government for wasting taxpayers' money on $2,000 an hour. Well, that would have to cost that to have a partner. The partner and maybe a admin person and maybe a junior staff with him. It have to be $2,000 an hour, and it have to be 24 hours a day, I would think. Or they may be just doing it on a fixed cost and say, here's the bill. We've got draft legislation. The bill's going to cost you, you know, $2 million or whatever the figure is, regardless of whether I put in an hour or I put in 20 or 200 hours. And the government gladly pays that. The ATO, which should have a, is, I think the ATO are the most powerful civil organisation in Australia. They have powers of entering people's homes, closing bank accounts, closing businesses, and they have all this, the backing of government and treasury behind them. And they haven't got a brain bank of a few lawyers in there to put together and draft legislation, or some ex-partners or senior accountants, CPAs or chartered accountants, that they have to hire PwC. But it comes back to what you said, Jason, and as the saying goes, no one gets fired for hiring IBM. And here the public service just wipe their hand over it. Oh, but hang on. It only seems in my reading that Peter Collins was advising. There might have been a few others as well. But what about the other advisors to this legislation? If the legislation was good, which apparently it wasn't anyway, and if he was holding back, yeah, that's not good. You haven't done your best for your client, and your client was the ATO. You haven't done well. But if he did his best and he wasn't holding anything back, and then when it was publicly released, went and told his clients, which a few articles are saying, yes, 23 people or businesses were contacted the day after budget. Well, that's just proactive management of your clients. Which is what you want to do as an accountant, being proactive as when a budget comes out, you're contacting them straight away.
Yeah, and there it is. So the murky story of PricewaterhouseCoopers continues, and the one thing that we're learning in all of this is that this is not the business of the average person in the street. This is big corporations getting tens of millions of dollars in fees, governments using taxpayer money to make their own jobs easier, and when And when the scandal hits, of course, it's one pushing against the other. It's a very disturbing situation. And probably to quote McCran at the end of this interview, more broadly, he says, the big accounting firms and the partners especially have waxed very, very rich by having their public sector consulting cake while also getting to chow down on their lucrative client fees, mixing and matching and munching to maximum benefit. Maybe they are or should be about to now choke on their gluttony, hence why partners at the other three are so ropeable. So we have both sides of the coin being argued here. McCran looking and wondering in all of this much ado about nothing, perhaps, but it still may result in the collapse or the embarrassment here and the value of PwC falling. It's Jason, a big story.
Do you find it interesting, and I do, that a public someone in the private sector, Peter Collins, can be named and shamed and by government, by the tax practitioner board, by the new boss of PwC, but who are the other writers of the legislation? Who are the public servant writers of the legislation? They're not named and shamed for their poor legislation that they put out. I mean, is this whole thing about, it doesn't seem to be about poor legislation. It's about a leak, a leak to clients, and these clients benefited. Well, as soon as the budget papers came out, PwC had the right, if they're charging those big fees, they need to be proactive with their clients or they're going to lose their clients. And clients are expecting after a budget, you're on top of it. You've got to tell your clients. And these other firms might be upset because they didn't get a part of the pie or asked to do part of the draft legislation, so they're going to bag the opposition as well. But if he broke confidentiality, not good for him at all. It's unethical. It's disturbing that would be the case. But if he didn't, and it just came out, everyone knows about the budget papers now, let's go market to our client base what we need to do. That's proactive. Looking after his business. If he held back, as you said before, that's a really big concern. He didn't do his best for his tax. But they're not saying that. You're saying it's leaked. When was it leaked? Was it leaked? If it was before, yes, an issue. If it's after, and he did his best for the ATA, no, I don't think so.
No, absolutely. To end the interview with Jeff today, I just want to quote a quote here from Stubbins, the acting CEO. Secondly, in relation to the breach of confidentiality, our clients were not involved in any wrongdoing and no confidential information was used to enable clients to pay less tax. So again, it really does feel like a storm in a teacup. So
what does that mean?
Yeah, so there you go. It is all the much ado about nothing with big people paying a heavy price here. And the real highlight here is the government seems to use as much largesse as possible to get its job done and throw anyone else under the bus at the same time. Thank you, Jeff Shaw. It's been great to catch up with you again, and I look forward to speaking with you soon on many other issues that are facing.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
What is a human being? We are described in the taxonomy of animals as Homo sapien, meaning the wise animal. The animal that is distinguished from other animals by the use of reason. And it was the use of reason that gave the Greeks the feeling that the human being had a soul, because the human alone seemed to share this capacity with the divine to reason, not to be governed purely by instinct and by the behaviours of the herd. Yet we find, I think, both as we read history, but also in our own lives, that each of us is subject to both the influence of reason, but also the passions of the herd.
Ross Cameron on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Radio works because of its ability to personalize to the listener.
What's exciting these days is that people are rediscovering it. You know, people are really rediscovering just how powerful radio is, how ubiquitous it is. It's in our cars, it's in our homes. There are so many new ways to access it. It's everywhere.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live. This is Compass with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Week after week, more countries are requesting to join BRICS, an informal group of nations named after the five letters there in the word: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, prompting Brazilian Foreign Minister Mauro Vieira to compare the BRICS and G20 to be more relevant than the G7. Now, South Africa is considering a law change over Vladimir Putin's International Criminal Court arrest warrant, as Johannesburg is scheduled to host the summit of BRICS, of which Russia is, of course, a leading member. South Africa is planning legislative changes to make its national law outrank that of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, according to a deputy minister. The move comes after the court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Putin. In June, we'll be submitting the law into Parliament. Obed Bapela, a deputy minister in the South African presidency, told the BBC. The legislation would allow South Africa to give itself exemptions of who to arrest and who not to arrest, Bapela said. In mid-March, the ICC issued arrest warrants for Russian President Putin and Maria Lvova-Belova, the presidential commissioner for children's rights. The court accused them of the forcible transfer of population, referring to Moscow's efforts to evacuate children from combat zones amid the hostilities with Ukraine. Russia responded by saying the ICC has no authority or legitimacy, as Moscow never ratified the 1998 Rome Statute that established the court. Under its current laws, South Africa is obliged to arrest the Russian president if he enters the country, as it is a member of the ICC. And in August, Johannesburg is scheduled to host the summit of BRICS, a comprising group, as I said, of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and at least 25 other countries and more counting who are lining up to join. Meanwhile, a youth activist and Pan-Africanism scholar, Masibo Freedom Dlamini, claimed that the ICC is biased and has allowed itself to be used in a political ballgame. Russia has been our friend when it was not fashionable, when no European country wanted to associate with us, he he added. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, when you consider that Putin and Belova both have arrest warrants against them from the court for the forcible transfer of population, helping children evacuate from combat zones. This feels like and seems like and will be backed up the same as what's happening with Imran Khan, the same that's what's happening with Donald Trump, this selectivity of certain events that get highlighted and blown up. And like we heard with Imran Khan this week, again, that he claims that the charges against him are frivolous and meaningless. And so this is the game that he's playing. But what's really interesting in all of this is that South Africa has realized which side its bread is buttered on and is making significant moves to change the law so that they can choose if they're going to honor this arrest warrant. And so the ICC, of which the United States do not take a part either, does Russia, is very much becoming a toothless tiger. Now, in another interesting story, the CIA hacked iPhones of diplomats in Russia, according to the Federal Security Service there. So Russian security officials claim to have uncovered a major surveillance operation exploiting Apple devices. They're saying that the CIA installed malware on thousands of Apple phones used by Russian citizens and foreign diplomats working in the country. And the FSB said on Thursday that a joint operation with the Federal Guard Service, the FSO, has uncovered a surveillance operation by American intelligence agencies carried out with the use of Apple's mobile devices. An assessment of Russia's telecom infrastructure revealed anomalies in the operations of some iPhones caused by a previously unknown malicious program that uses software vulnerabilities provided by the manufacturer, a statement by the agency read. Several thousand phones made by Apple were infected with malware, according to the FSB. Not only were citizens targeted, but also foreign phone numbers and subscribers that use SIM cards registered with diplomatic missions and embassies inside Russia, including countries from the NATO bloc and the post-Soviet space, as well as Israel, Syria, and China. The discovery is more proof of the close cooperation between Apple and the US intelligence community, claims the Russian Federal Security Service, adding that the declared policy of ensuring the privacy of personal data of Apple users has nothing to do with reality. The FSB has also accused Apple of providing the American intelligence services with a range of opportunities to survey any persons of interest to the White House, including their partners in anti-Russian activities, as well as their own citizens. Back in March, the Kommersant newspaper reported that members of the Russian presidential administration had been told to discard their iPhones. According to the paper, the step was taken due to concerns that advanced cyberware tools such as Israeli Pegasus software could allow Apple gadgets to be breached despite the producers' claims of their enhanced security features. Meanwhile, Apple has denied Russia's claim that it had allowed US intelligence services to use its products in order to spy on diplomats. We have never worked with any government to insert a backdoor into any Apple product and never will, a spokesman for the company said in a statement to the media on Thursday. The denial came after Russia's Federal Security Service accused the US intelligence agencies of installing malware on Apple smartphones used by Russian diplomats, as well as diplomats from other countries, including, as we said, Israel, China, and Syria. The allegations were made as Washington and Moscow are locked in the most serious diplomatic standoff in decades due to the ongoing Ukraine conflict. It's fascinating, again, the shenanigans that are being played out, and you could not tell the difference anymore between a spy movie and what's happening in real time. And more interestingly now, Zelensky in Ukraine is demanding that NATO and the EU membership for Kyiv, as the argues that the alternatives would be an open war or a creeping occupation by Russia. Russia, he says, is afraid of NATO, as he argues before the European political community in a meeting being held in Moldova. Moscow, he claimed, tries to swallow only those who are outside that common security space. Every European country that borders Russia should be a full member of the EU and NATO, Zelensky said. There are only two alternatives to this, an open war or a creeping Russian occupation. Admitting Ukraine would send a sign to Moldova, Georgia, and Belarus, he claimed, but if even Ukrainians who are proving our commitment to freedom and the values of a united Europe with blood, but have not yet heard a clear positive answer about joining the EU and NATO, the hopes of others are being completely elusive. Both NATO and the EU have long-standing policies of not admitting new members if they are currently engaged in conflicts or have unresolved territorial disputes. Through both blocs have made multiple exceptions for Ukraine since last year. The Germans at least appeared unwilling to cross that line. And German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock has insisted. Last month, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz also expressed skepticism about Kiev's admission into the US-led military bloc. Speaking ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign minister in Oslo on Thursday, Baerbock claimed that the bloc's doors remain open for potential new members. This applies to Sweden in particular, but also to Ukraine. So, at the same time, it is clear we cannot talk about new membership in the middle of a war. It is a complicated and confusing world when Zelensky is screaming to be let into NATO, which obviously he can't cope on his own, and Russia is standing there cleaning them out on a number of different levels, and we're waiting for somehow the truth in all of this to be revealed. But of course, Western media will only give you one side of the story. Let's pause for news headlines and more after the break.
Turn on the news.
I have a little news flash.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Serious concerns are growing over the health of America's aging president after the 80-year-old took a nasty fall at an Air Force graduation ceremony in Colorado. Poland is refusing to send any of its F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine because it barely has enough for itself. And it's been revealed the Netherlands is looking to buy almost 100 more Leopard tanks as well as Patriot missiles to send to Ukraine.
This is Compass with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. TNT.
Many of us are confused by the trajectory authority is taking in terms of how we as humans are shortcutting our freedoms to protect us and keep us safe. Without a second thought, our freedoms were erased and attacked by authority determined to inject us to save us all from the big fat cold. Despite recognizing this overreach, global authorities are still pushing ahead at the World Health Assembly for the World Health Organization to consolidate advisory boards into a permanent authority, prompting many to ask, are we even the same anymore? I often wonder, do our rich and powerful think that they are better than us, perhaps superior? So I found this story intriguing. Suddenly, the origins of the human species is again open for reflection. And this is a story that appeared in Nature magazine this week. The human family tree is a tangle of twisted branches. Parting the foliage to disentangle the system of our species is not so easy. The classic out of Africa hypothesis suggests that Homo sapiens evolved from a distinct lineage of early humans that arose around 150,000 years ago before setting off to spread through Europe and beyond. But there's another story. A genomic study led by researchers at McGill University and the University of California, Davis, suggests our family history isn't a straight line tracing back through a slowly changing population, but a web connecting a diversity of families stretching across the African continent. The findings support a multi-regional hypothesis, which argues that before our species left for Africa for Europe, there was continuous gene flow between at least two different populations. At different times, people who embraced the classic model of a single origin for Homo sapiens suggested that humans first emerged in either East or Southern Africa, and that was explained by geneticist Brenna Hen from the University of California, Davis. But it has been difficult to reconcile these theories with the limited fossil and archaeological records of human occupation from sites as far afield as Morocco, Ethiopia, and South Africa, which show that Homo sapiens were found to be living across continents as far back as 300,000 years ago. The oldest fossils in Africa that resemble our own species were found in Morocco, Ethiopia, and Southern Africa. But it is not clear which of these regions hosts the true cradle of humankind. Some researchers argue that because we've been thinking about our human origins all wrong, maybe the stem of our species is actually a braid of branches created when a patchwork of coexisting populations migrate and mix. genetic data seems to support that idea. Comparing the genomes of 290 modern-day people in South Africa, Sierra Leone, Ethiopia, and Eurasia, researchers found evidence of high gene flow between their ancestors in Eastern and Western Africa. They included genetic data from British individuals to represent gene flow back into Africa through colonial invasion, and a well-studied ancient Neanderthal genome from Croatia to account for genes from Neanderthals mixing with humans outside Africa. Under a model of continuous migration, there could be two main lineages responsible for the genomes of those living in Africa today. These lineages represent distinct populations of early humans living in different parts of Africa around 400,000 years ago. Models suggest after evolving independently for a stretch of time on opposing sides of the continent, the two populations might have merged, ultimately fracturing into subpopulations that persisted from 120,000 years ago. Shifts in wet and dry conditions around the African continent between 140 Ka and 100 Ka may have prompted these merger events between different divergent stems. This intertwined lineage, they say, could have been the one to leave Africa for Europe about 50,000 years ago, but models have predicted that humans in Africa left for Europe 10,000 years after they should have. So, however, suggest that there may have been multiple ways of migration from Africa to Europe. Given the sparse record of fossils for this time, genomic sequencing has become an incredible tool for scientists retracing the steps of our ancestors. The more genetic data experts read, the more complicated their story and our story becomes. Now, China is always in the thick of things. There's nothing that China, it seems, won't attempt. They have the Belt and Road initiatives going all around the world, rebuilding infrastructure for all forms of countries, Western and East Africa, Ethiopia, and many, including Victoria, although that was temporarily, it seems, suspended there. But their partnership also expands in the international north-south transport corridor. That is a massive railway line joining, running through Iran that links Russia above China and India below, and will have passages going into Africa. It's quite incredible. And if you've ever seen a drone swarm, like recently displayed at the Vivid show in Sydney, but with more action, and then apply it to AI-controlled military might, it just seems that China keeps on going. So what's their latest adventure? Chinese scientists have mysteriously begun digging a 10,000-meter deep hole as the country searches for a way to become the world's biggest economy underground and in space. China, currently home to the world's second largest economy, began drilling what will become its deepest ever borehole on Tuesday, according to the official Xinhua news agency. It's not entirely clear what the purpose is, but the fact that it's begun to dig in the oil-rich region of Xinjiang may provide a clue. I just find it fascinating that we have a hole 10 kilometers deep. That's certainly deep enough to dig for more than oil. It will take 457 days for the hole to reach full depth. It is part of a series of projects to explore deep earth and space. According to China's Natural Petroleum Group, which is spearheading the project, the hole will provide data on Earth's internal structure while also testing deep underground drilling technologies. The drill, which has a design depth of over 11,000 meters, comprises of drill bits and drill pipes that will force their way through the Tarim Basin in northwest China's Xinhua Uyghur Autonomous Region. 457 days later, we'll see what happens, but President Xi Jinping called for greater progress in the deep earth exploration in a speech addressing some of the nation's leading scientists back in 2021. It's important to note that it will not quite surpass the world's deepest man-made hole, which is the Kola Superdeep Hole, begun by the Soviet Union and which reached a depth of 12,262 meters in 1989, after 20 years of drilling. We'll be back with more after the break on TNT.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Florida isn't as conservative as it would have you believe, and neither is Texas. And in both instances, it's the same root cause. Republicans doing the bidding of Democrats as part of the Uniparty. After his drunken disaster earlier in the week, Texas House Speaker Wade Fallon led the impeachment against State Attorney General Ken Paxton, primarily because he was the biggest thorn in Obama's side and is currently the biggest thorn in Joe Biden's side. Paxton has been fending off spurious charges regarding financial dealings, personal dealings, etc., for almost a decade. Voters have had three opportunities to choose someone else, and they have resoundingly brought Ken Paxton back each and every time. The Senate trial is not expected to be the same cockamamie, corrupt kangaroo court proceeding as occurred in the House on Friday, and Paxton is finally expected to be vindicated. But this entire episode is People's Exhibit number one as to why Texans need to start voting smarter when they pull that R lever. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity.
You're with Jason Olborn and Compass on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Pick up any newspaper or flick on the telly and you are going to hear that Ben Roberts Smith is a war criminal today after losing a defamation case yesterday. The story is so incredibly sad and disappointing at a time when the world has already been turned on its head. It's one thing to isolate a soldier who may have done bad deeds and he still hasn't been charged with any criminal charges at this point and say that it does not involve others, but it does. And that's the point, especially when you learn of the conditions in Afghanistan.
Ben Roberts Smith's dismissal of his defamation case yesterday has certainly set a cat amongst the pigeons, not only in Australia, but in, of course, military circles as well. Despite not being charged with any crimes, it feels like and seems like that this has been trial by media in a very, very disturbing case. I've asked Peter Richards, retired military and a man who has served on multiple tours, including in Afghanistan, for his thoughts on this particular story. Peter, as a retired vet, how do you feel about the situation and the story unfolding, and what is it going to do to the rest of the military, specifically as people in Australia and the media don't understand necessarily the details of what's happening here?
Well, it's going to have a profound effect on the ADF, and especially young soldiers coming through, for reasons being that they're going to feel that the government is not going to have their back, especially if they're sent into a conflict zone. And conflict is a very imprecise environment to go into, because you never really know what's going to happen from day to day, especially when you're fighting an enemy that is very unpredictable. And certainly blending in amongst the population as we did in Afghanistan. To probably put some background to this, Jason, would be the aspect that you've got is you've got 14 indigenous tribes in Afghanistan that all hate each other, that lived a culture of a warlord culture where they would look after their own tribes, look after themselves, and generally corruption is the word of the day. Now, when the Taliban took over command of the whole country, essentially they were just the biggest tribe on the block at the time. And then when they started training Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda became a part of the landscape, and obviously the global war on terrorism occurred, the issue was that, you know, we went in to kick out Al-Qaeda originally, but the Taliban had to go as well because they were supporting the Al-Qaeda offensive on the Western world at the time. Now, the issue you've got with that is that there were people who had essentially been placed into positions of power within the Taliban at the time, and that power was throughout the country. And yet you'd had a force in the north, which was the Northern Alliance, which essentially then sided with coalition forces to fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Now, there was a lot of ill will that was harboured from that. Now, when you look historically, the Russians faced exactly the same thing when they were there in the 80s, where you had an alliance that aligned with the Russians, and then you had an alliance that was with the Mujahideen. Afghanistan's gone through this this sort of fighting for centuries. And for us to go in there with, you know, political expediency and a quick solution to the war on terror was never, ever going to be the case, especially when you're fighting 14 indigenous tribes that have all got a different approach to life and all hate each other and will certainly side with each other against another common foe or another tribe. And the culture itself is just riddled with corruption. So the issue we had fighting there is that we'd have our political types with their laws of armed conflict and their ROE, or rules of engagement, that we would have to be sitting there and we'd have to abide by, and yet what would be happening on the ground would definitely not reflect what their political ambitions were or their strategic ambitions were, which would put us soldiers on the ground in harm's way a lot. And I'll give you a couple of for instances of where we'd be training ANA soldiers or Afghan National Army soldiers who were infiltrated by the Taliban, who would then murder our guys in forward operating bases when they're supposedly in a safe, secure environment, and they're unarmed, and they're training these soldiers, and then these soldiers would turn these weapons on and kill our guys. Now, how are you supposed to train people that you can't trust? The next thing is that our reconstruction forces would go in there and they would be training people to build schools, infrastructure, that sort of thing. We'd be training these carpenters and so on, and then they'd be taking tools away and they're making IED pressure plates out of things like hand saws. You know, you can't fight a corrupt culture, and you certainly can't provide a Western strategic point of view or democracy template and the laws of armed conflict on a guerrilla-type army or an indigenous culture that is full of corruption. And it's near on nigh impossible to do it. I mean, in the end, we were fighting kids who would be armed with mobile phones that would blow us up, or we'd have farmers that would be digging in IEDs because they're being paid by the Taliban or threatened by the Taliban to put these IEDs in. Then they'd become the target, and then they were unarmed. And we supposedly couldn't fire on anybody that wasn't a positive identified threat. Yet I've got this person digging a hole, putting in an ID that is there to blow me up, you know, and blow my mates up.
Yep, so technically unarmed, but not, because he's setting up an improvised explosive device to use as a bomb to kill you.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, that's how they usurped our ROE all the time. And the ROE that we would get would be absolutely hamstringing us in the way that we could fight this war, because they knew how they could get around it. You could have a farmer, and I'll give you another, for instance, one of our Dutch Special Forces coalition actually took photos of guys as they were going out, because they looked like they were doing something sus in their own fields, because they had fields of marijuana and they had corn and all that mixed in with it in the Greenbelt. And the Dutch Jaegers actually took photos of them as they were going out, because they were going, oh, there's something's not right here. And then as they were coming back, they came back in virtually the same direction, because they were channeled on where they could go. These same farmers ended up firing at them. They were actually Taliban or Taliban sympathisers. And they got into a contact, they killed them, but thankfully, the Dutch Jaegers at the time had taken photos of these guys, and they were positively identified as combatants. But the point is that they let them pass. And you would have children holding mobile phones. The Taliban would tell them to ring a number, and that would be the precursor to set off the IED.
Yes.
Now, you don't see too many kids holding mobile phones in Afghanistan, so straight away they become a threat. And if you've had that happen to you before, well, then Taliban know that. And then what they do is they use those children as effectively a barrier, because they know that we're not going to try and fire on children, and we don't want to.
Mm.
But they know that that's our weakness. These are the imperfections of ROE and the unrealistic conditions that we had to fight that war in. And media, you know, self-righteous media that are currently going after Ben Robert Smith and the ABC, the government, this is nothing more than a political witch hunt. If you're going to do this, if you're going to start hanging our soldiers out to dry because they were fighting a war that wouldn't reflect what they were hearing in the political offices in Canberra or in the media, because we were in a position that we had to think on the ground and we had to think to save our own lives. And we were fighting an enemy that would constantly be changing their tactics every day. And ROE just is not designed, all the laws of armed conflict are not designed to keep up with guerrilla warfare. You can't fight a war that way.
Now, I just want to quote from Greg Sheridan's article today in The Australian. He says, all these laws allow and sometimes require fierce and deadly combat, but they don't allow for the intentional killing of civilians or of prisoners. So what we're finding here and what we're talking about today, Peter, is that there is a very, very murky grey area between civilian and operative in this case, if you're specifically deal with improvised explosive devices, IEDs, that may be just a farmer planting them. This is not as simple as a civilian. And I think this is where this grey area that's not being explained in the mainstream media. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, I would actually take you to Afghanistan tomorrow if I could, and I'd say to you, who's Taliban and who's a farmer?
Mm.
And you'd be flat-pressed trying to find out which one's which. We could go one side of, for instance, in Mirambad and in the Chora district, one side of the river was pro-Taliban and the other side of the river wasn't.
Mm.
You know, it all depended on who was paying who that day. And we could go there a month later and it would change completely. You never knew who you were fighting. And the Vietnam era guys had exactly the same problem in Vietnam, because guerrilla warfare is designed to blend into the public.
Mm-hmm.
And it's death by a thousand cuts. And this is just one of those thousand cuts. You know, they've undermined coalition. They've undermined our soldiers, and unfortunately we're the low-hanging fruit because we're the easy targets.
Mm.
Whereas the political types that put us in there to start with, where are they being held account for this? Where are the generals being held account for this? Where are any of these people that put us into these battlefields to start with and gave us the ridiculous ROE that we had to stand by and try and survive on, and the deaths of innocent Australian soldiers at the hands of so-called allies? Why aren't they being held to account? You know, that was their decisions, those strategic decisions to train ANA, and that resulted in the deaths of Australian soldiers. You know, why aren't they being held accountable?
This is the hardest part of all of this, is that we're meant to be held to a higher standard, but here we are playing in one of the dirtiest wars that there are, and there isn't really a clean war anywhere. Who's playing by the rules anymore? And it's a sad day for Australia. It's a sad day for everyone around the world when it is just not understood. And yet another person, regardless of the situation, Ben Robert Smith has not been charged with any crimes at this point, and here we are throwing our own under the bus in a disturbing story that is clearly hurting many, many more people in the Australian Defence Force, and those in the media and the public that don't fully understand may just appreciate the difficulties in all of this. The last question, Peter, is there any way or any better understanding where everyone's going to be talking about ways to improve in all of this, but from a soldier's perspective, what could we possibly do different knowing what we know now?
There isn't really anything you can do. I mean, the fog of war is the fog of war for a reason.
Mm.
It's when you go into a battle, a battlefield, other than the absolute certainty that you're going to have your life threatened and that you've got to protect life and you've got to protect the lives around you, you can't plan for the enemy to the nth degree. We can have what they call standard operating procedure or SOPs. We can have actions on where you know, you can sort of have generic actions on to ambush and so on and so forth, that you can plan, you can sort of plan to a point. But on many occasions, we leave the gate overseas and go outside the wire, and our orders changed within 5 seconds of leaving the firm base. And the reason being is the political and strategic aspects would change, and change daily. It all depends on who's running the show in the grand scheme of things. If you've got a corrupt government that we're supposedly supporting and trying to bring democracy to a country that's never had it, and you've got strategic military objectives that are at loggerheads with political strategic objectives, you can never have an answer for that. There is no answer for it. And unfortunately, it's the guys on the ground that are pushing the extension of that political objective that end up being the ones that are hung out to dry. So I haven't got an answer for that, mate. I really don't know how to answer it, because we're not in a position that we've got the ability to be able to look into the future and go, well, hang on, if I do this, what's the negative ramifications 20 years down the track? It's just not, you just can't answer that.
You can't answer the question.
It's life or death at that point. You know, it's your life or it's a guy on the other end of another AK-47.
Yep.
You know,
Yeah. Now, the point being there that if soldiers at the coalface are short of answers and being able to predict what's happening in 20 years, it's going to be very difficult to think that politicians sitting in a room can come up with an answer of how they're going to change the rules of engagement or protect, in other words. And realistically, the only answer to all of this is don't get into any more wars. What else can you do if you don't expect it to be dirty?
And the unfortunate thing is that that's unavoidable as well. I mean, we'll never be in that position. I mean, human nature will never, ever have that. I mean, here's the thing. We've got, and even though this isn't related to the subject, it is related to the fact of poor decision-making by our political types. We've got thousands upon thousands, in case globally, millions upon millions of unexplained deaths at the moment from this freaking COVID crap, right? Who are the people being held accountable for that?
Yeah, good point.
And the decisions they made. They murdered far more than Ben Robert Smith supposedly did, or any of us ever did, you know?
Yeah.
And this is the thing that really, really annoys me. You know, you've got 31 bobbleheads sitting in the Senate who basically voted down seven other senators who were trying to do the right thing to have an investigation into COVID. And yet, they're all happy to hang us out to dry, but none of these political types who actually made these decisions for COVID that actually did kill people in our own country. You know, so as far as I'm concerned, this is just nothing but a witch hunt, and it's going to it will have ramifications for the ADF for years and years after this, long after this clown circus that's running the country now are out of power and gone, and they won't care.
No, they won't.
And this is historic. Soldiers have always been thrown under the bus for poor political decisions and strategic decisions, which at the end of the day, you know, I went to Iraq. Did I agree with going to Iraq? In hindsight, no. We didn't need to go there, but we did. And I was a soldier at the time, and I did as I was told.
Yep.
You know, the point is that we're all the ones, always the ones made to be the scapegoat. And this goes way back to Breaker Morant. You know, Breaker Morant was made a scapegoat in exactly the same sort of scenario and exactly the same sort of thing, where he had to deal with a guerrilla force in the Boers. And in the end, we ended up in a position where we've got people dictating to soldiers on the ground because of their actions that they were never there, and they were armchair critics and have got no idea of what real war is.
Yeah, thanks, Peter, for explaining in great detail the difficulties and the hardship that many, many people in the defence are struggling with today. All right, so it's a really difficult time for the defence, as you've heard in that interview with Peter Richards, who has fought many tours, and it's just a really, really difficult time for everyone. And I just, heart goes out across the world, in fact, to any soldier who's really struggling. And we know how difficult it is with PTSD all around, and so many not being able to really deal with this in a difficult time, as I've just said. Now,
Over the weekend, you can join TNT Radio on the annual pilgrimage to the healing city of Bath in southwest England to hear the pioneers and innovators of our time reveal how excellent health has been hidden from us and explore what the reveal means for the better world we are co-creating. The Better Way Conference 2023 at the Apex Hotel in Bath, UK until Sunday, June 4, unveiling a better way for health, freedom and sovereignty. The Better Way Conference 2023. And of course, you're only going to get that here on TNT Radio. How exciting it is that you can get involved, get out there if you're in Bath and go and see what's happening. And of course, listen in on TNT Radio. Coming up after the news, Chris Smith will be here, Dean Macken to follow. It's the only place you want to be. Drop the antenna, get online, download the app, and of course, listen to TNT Radio wherever you go. Goodness me, how good it is to flick on that app in the Bluetooth in the car. You're not going to want anything else. Thanks for listening to me this week. I look forward to being back on Monday with a whole lot of big news coming up. This is TNT Radio.